Chapter 35. To me there is something very touching in the notion of that little pinch of comfort doled out to Granny, and gratefully inhaled by her in the darkness. Don't you remember what traditions there used to be of chests of plate, bulses of diamonds, laces of inestimable value, sent out of the country privately by the old queen, to enrich certain relations in MCKLNBRGSTRLTZ? Not all the treasure went. Non omnis mortar. A poor old palsied thing at midnight is made happy sometimes as she lifts her shaking old hand to her nose, gliding noiselessly among the beds, where lie the poor creatures huddled in their cheerless dormitory. I fancy an old ghost with a snuff box that does not creak. Here, goody, take of my rappee. You will not sneeze, and I shall not say God bless you. ... But you will think kindly of old Queen Charlotte, won't you? Ah! I had a many troubles. I was a prisoner, almost so much as you are. I had to eat boiled mutton every day. Enter nouse, I abominated it. But I never complained. I swallowed it. I made the best of a hard life. We have all our burdens to bear. But hark! I hear the cock crow, and snuff the morning air. And with this the royal ghost vanishes up the chimney, if there be a chimney in that dismal harem, where poor old Twashos and her companions pass their nights, their dreary nights, their restless nights, their cold long nights, shared in what glum companionship, illumined by what a feeble taper. Did I understand you, my good Twashos, to say that your mother was 27 years old when you were born, and that she married your esteemed father when she herself was 25. 1745, then, was the date of your dear mother's birth. I dare say her father was absent in the Low Countries, with His Royal Highness the Duke of Cumberland, under whom he had the honor of carrying a halberd at the famous engagement of Fontenoy, or if not there, he may have been at Preston Pans, under General Sir John Cope, when the wild Highlanders broke through all the laws of discipline and the English lines, and, being on the spot, did he see the famous ghost which didn't appear to Colonel Gardiner of the Dragoons? My good creature, is it possible you don't remember that Dr. Swift, Sir Robert Walpole, my Lord Orford, as you justly say, old Sarah Marlborough, and little Mr. Pope, of Twickenham, died in the year of your birth? What a wretched memory you have! What? Haven't they a library, and the commonest books of reference at the old convent of St. Lazarus, where you dwell? Convent of St. Lazarus, Prince William, Dr. Swift, Atossa, and Mr. Pope, of Twickenham. What is the gentleman talking about? Says old Goody, with a oh, oh, and a laugh like an old parrot. You know they live to be as old as Methuselah, parrots do, and a parrot of 100 is comparatively young, oh, oh, oh. Dot yes, and likewise carps live to an immense old age. Some which Frederick the Great fed at San Salcai are there now, with great humps of blue mold on their old backs, and they could tell all sorts of queer stories, if they chose to speak, but they are very silent. Carps are of their nature few communicatives. Oh! What has been thy long life, old Goody, but a dole of bread and water, and a perch on a cage, a dreary swim round and round a lead of a pond? What are Rossbach or Gina to those moldy ones, and do they know it is a grandchild of England who brings bread to feed them? No. Those San Salcai carps may live to be 1,000 years old, and have nothing to tell, but that one day is like another, and the history of friend Goody Twashos has not much more variety than theirs. Hard labor, hard fare, hard bed, numbing cold all night, and gnawing hunger most days. That is her lot. Is it lawful in my prayers to say, thank heaven, I am not as one of these? If I were 80, would I like to feel the hunger always gnawing, gnawing? To have to get up and make a bow, when Mr. Bumble the Beetle entered the common room. To have to listen to Miss Prim, who came to give me her ideas of the next world. If I were 80, I own I should not like to have to sleep with another gentleman of my own age, gouty, a bad sleeper, kicking in his old dreams, and snoring, to march down my veil of years at word of command, accommodating my tottering old steps to those of the other prisoners in my dingy, hopeless old gang, to hold out a trembling hand for a sicky pittance of gruel, and say, "Thank you, ma'am," to Miss Prim, when she has done reading her sermon. John. When Goody Twashows comes next Friday, I desire she may not be disturbed by theological controversies. You have a very fair voice, and I heard you and the mate singing a hymn very sweetly the other night, and was thankful that our humble household should be in such harmony. Poor old Twashows is so old and toothless and quaky that she can't sing a bit, but don't be giving yourself airs over her, because she can't sing and you can. Make her comfortable at our kitchen hearth. Set that old kettle to sing by our hob. Warm her old stomach with nut brown ale and a toast laid in the fire. Be kind to the poor old schoolgirl of 90 who has had leave to come out for a day of Christmas holiday. Shall there be many more Christmases for thee? Think of the 90 she has seen already, the 40 and 10 cold, cheerless, nipping New Year's. If you were in her place, would you like to have a remembrance of better early days, when you were young, and happy, and loving, perhaps, or would you prefer to have no past on which your mind could rest? About the year 1788, Goody, were your cheeks rosy, and your eyes bright, and did some young fellow in powder, and a pigtail look in them? We may grow old, but to us some stories never are old. On a sudden they rise up, not dead, but living, not forgotten, but freshly remembered. The eyes gleam on us as they used to do. The dear voice thrills in our hearts. The rapture of the meeting, the terrible, terrible parting, again and again the tragedy is acted over. Yesterday, in the street, I saw a pair of eyes so like two which used to brighten at my coming once, that the whole past came back as I walked lonely, in the rush of the Strand, and I was young again in the midst of joys and sorrows, alike sweet and sad, alike sacred and fondly remembered. If I tell a tale out of school, will any harm come to my old schoolgirl? Once, a lady gave her a half-sovereign, which was a source of great pain and anxiety to Goody Twashows. She sewed it away in her old stays somewhere, thinking here at least was a safe investment.
Vestus, a vest and investment. Pardon me, thou poor old thing, but I cannot help the pleasantry.
And what do you think? Another pensioner of the establishment cut the coin out of Goody's stays, an old woman who went upon two crutches. Faugh, the old witch. What? Violence amongst these toothless, tottering, trembling, feeble ones? Robbery amongst the penniless? Dogs coming and snatching Lazarus's crumbs out of his lap? Ah, how indignant Goody was as she told the story. To that pond at Peasdom, where the carps live for hundreds of years, with hunches of blue mold on their back, I dare say the little prince and princess of Prius and Britannian come sometimes with crumbs and cakes to feed the moldy ones. Those eyes may have goggled from beneath the weeds at Napoleon's jackboots. They have seen Frederick's lean shanks reflected in their pool, and perhaps Monsieur de Voltaire has fed them, and now, for a crumb of biscuit they will fight, push, hustle, rob, squabble, gobble, relapsing into their tranquility when the ignoble struggle is over. Sans souci, indeed. It is mighty well riding and sousy over the gate, but where is the gate through which care has not slipped? She perches on the shoulders of the sentry in the sentry box. She whispers the porter sleeping in his armchair. She glides up the staircase, and lies down between the king and queen in their bed royal. This very night I dare say she will perch upon poor old Goody Twashow's meager bolster, and whisper, "Will the gentleman and those ladies ask me again?" No, no, they will forget poor old Twashow's. Goody, for shame of yourself. Do not be cynical. Do not mistrust your fellow creatures. What? Has the Christmas morning dawned upon thee 90 times? For 40 and 10 years has it been thy lot to totter on this earth, hungry and obscure? Peace and goodwill to thee, let us say, at this Christmas season. Come, drink, eat, rest a while at our hearth, thou poor old pilgrim.
and of the bread which God's bounty gives us. I pray, brother reader, we may not forget to set aside a part for those noble and silent poor, from whose innocent hands war has torn the means of labor. Enough. As I hope for befit Christmas, I vow a note shall be sent to St. Lazarus Union House, in which Mr. Roundabout requests the honor of Mrs. Twasho's company on Friday, 26th December. Au dehors de mon chapeau. Never have I seen a more noble tragic face. In the center of the forehead there was a great furrow of care, towards which the brows rose piteously. What a deep solemn grief in the eyes. They looked blankly at the object before them, but through it, as it were, and into the grief beyond. In moments of pain, have you not looked at some indifferent object so? It mingles dumbly with your grief, and remains afterwards connected with it in your mind. It may be some indifferent thing, a book which you were reading at the time when you received her farewell letter. How well you remember the paragraph afterwards, the shape of the words, and their position on the page. The words you were writing when your mother came in and said it was all over. She was married, Emily married to that insignificant little rival at whom you have laughed 100 times in her company. Well, well, my friend and reader, whether you be old man or young, wife or maiden, you have had your grief pang. Boy, you have lain awake the first night at school, and thought of home. Worse still, man, you have parted from the dear ones with bursting heart. And, lonely boy, recall the bolstering and unfeeling comrade gave you. And, lonely man, just torn from your children their little tokens of affection yet in your pocket, pacing the deck at evening in the midst of the roaring ocean, you can remember how you were told that supper was ready, and how you went down to the cabin and had brandy and water and biscuit. You remember the taste of them. Yes, forever. You took them whilst you and your grief were sitting together, and your grief clutched you round the soul. Serpent, how you have writhed round me and bitten me. Remorse, remembrance, and see, come in the night season, and I feel you gnawing, gnawing. I tell you that man's face was like Laocoon's, which, by the way, I always think overrated. The real head is at Brussels, at the Duke d'Arenberg's, not at Rome. That man. What man? That man of whom I said that his magnificent countenance exhibited the noblest tragic woe. He was not of European blood. He was handsome, but not of European beauty. His face white, not of a northern whiteness. His eyes protruding somewhat, and rolling in their grief. Those eyes had seen the orient sun, and his beak was the eagle's. His lips were full. The beard, curling round them, was unkempt and tawny. The locks were of a deep, deep coppery red. The hands, swart and powerful, accustomed to the rough grasp of the wares in which he dealt, seemed unused to the flimsy artifices of the bath. He came from the wilderness, and its sands were on his robe, his cheek, his tattered sandal, and the hardy foot it covered. And his grief, whence came his sorrow? I will tell you. He bore it in his hand. He had evidently just concluded the compact by which it became his. His business was that of a purchaser of domestic raiment. At early dawn, nay, at what hour when the city is alive, do we not all hear the nasal cry of, lo? In Paris, habits, galens, mark and abbots, is the twanging signal with which the wandering merchant makes his presence known. It was in Paris I saw this man. Where else have I not seen him? In the Roman ghetto at the Gate of David, in his father's once imperial city. The man I mean was an itinerant vendor and purchaser of wardrobes, what you call an... enough. You know his name. On his left shoulder hung his bag, and he held in that hand a white hat, which I am sure he had just purchased, and which was the cause of the grief which smote his noble features. Of course I cannot particularize the sum, but he had given too much for that hat. He felt he might have got the thing for less money. It was not the amount, I am sure, it was the principle involved. He had given 4 pence, let us say, for that which 3 pence would have purchased. He had been done. And a manly shame was upon him, that he, whose energy, acuteness, experience,
point of honor, should have made him the victor in any mercantile duel in which he should engage, had been overcome by a porter's wife, who very likely sold him the old hat, or by a student who was tired of it. I can understand his grief. Do I seem to be speaking of it in a disrespectful or flippant way? Then you mistake me. He had been outwitted. He had desired, coaxed, schemed, haggled, got what he wanted, and now found he had paid too much for his bargain. You don't suppose I would ask you to laugh at that man's grief? It is you, clumsy cynic, who are disposed to sneer, whilst it may be tears of genuine sympathy are trickling down this nose of mine. What do you mean by laughing? If you saw a wounded soldier on the field of battle, would you laugh? If you saw a ewe robbed of her lamb, would you laugh, you brute? It is you who are the cynic, and have no feeling. And you sneer, because that grief is unintelligible to you which touches my finer sensibility. The old clothes man had been defeated in one of the daily battles of his most interesting, checkered, adventurous life. Have you ever figured to yourself what such a life must be? The pursuit and conquest of twopence must be the most eager and fascinating of occupations. We might all engage in that business if we would. Do not whist players, for example, toil and think and lose their temper over sixpenny points? They bring study, natural genius, long forethought, memory, and careful historical experience to bear upon their favorite labor. Don't tell me that it is the sixpenny points and 5 shillings the rub which keeps them for hours over their painted pasteboard. It is the desire to conquer. Hours pass by. Night glooms. Dawn, it may be, rises unheeded, and they sit calling for fresh cards at the Ortland or the Nyan, while waning candles splutter in the sockets and languid waiters snooze in the anteroom. Soul rises. Jones has lost 4 pounds. Brown has won 2. Robinson lurks away to his family house and, mayhap indignant, misses our hours of evening, night, morning, have passed away, whilst they have been waging this sixpenny battle. What is the loss of 4 pounds to Jones, the gain of 2 to Brown? B is, perhaps, so rich that 2 pounds more or less are as naught to him. J is so hopelessly involved that to win 4 pounds cannot benefit his creditors or alter his condition, but they play for that stake. They put forward their best energies. They rough, finesse, what are the technical words, and how do I know? It is but a sixpenny game if you like, but they want to win it. So as regards my friend yonder with the hat, he stakes his money. He wishes to win the game, not the hat merely. I am not prepared to say that he is not inspired by a noble ambition. Caesar wished to be first in a village. If first of 100 yokels, why not first of 2? And my friend the old clothes man wishes to win his game, as well as to turn his little sixpence. Suppose in the game of life, and it is but a twopenny game after all, you are equally eager of winning. Shall you be ashamed of your ambition, or glory in it? There are games, too, which are becoming to particular periods of life. I remember in the days of our youth, when my friend Arthur Bowler was an eminent cricketer. Slim, swift, strong, well-built, he presented a goodly appearance on the ground in his flannel uniform. Militis di non sine gloria, Bowler my boy. Hush. We tell no tales. Mum is the word. Yonder comes Chancy his son. Now Chancy his son has taken the field, and is famous among the 11 of his school. Bowler Sr., with his capacious waistcoat, and C, waddling after a ball, would present an absurd object, whereas it does the eyes good to see Bowler Jr. scouring the plain a young exemplar of joyful health, vigor, activity. The old boy wisely contents himself with amusements more becoming his age and waist, takes his sober ride, visits his farm soberly, busies himself about his pigs, his plowing, his peaches, or what not. Very small routineer amusements interest him, and, thank goodness, nature provides very kindly for kindly disposed fogies. We relish those things which we scorned in our lusty youth. I see the young folks of an evening kindling and glowing over their delicious novels. I look up and watch the eager eye flashing down the page, being, for my part, perfectly contented with my twaddling old volume of Howell's Letters, or the Gentleman's Magazine. I am actually arrived at such a calm frame of mind, that I like batter pudding. I never should have believed it possible, but it is so. Yet a little while, and I may relish water gruel. It will be the age of mon late de Paule mon bonnet de nuit. And then the cotton extinguisher is pulled over the old noddle, and the little flame of life is popped out. Don't you know elderly people who make learned notes in army lists, peerages, and the like? This is the batter pudding, water gruel of old age. The worn-out old digestion does not care for stronger food. Formerly it could swallow 12 hours tough reading and digest an encyclopedia. If I had children to educate, I would, at 10 or 12 years of age, have a professor, or professoress, of whist for them, and cause Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.